Ross, thank you for giving both of my pseudonyms. I'm both Hollis Dodge, I'm Greg Dodge. They're just names are next door to one another. I trade them pretty indiscriminately. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I also have a 4-year-old daughter who gave me her cold about 3 or 4 days ago. And I'm awfully happy to be here, so I've got enough Hall's mentholyptus, I think, to get me through the hour. Then I'm going to go home and beat her. When you give a talk about AA's history, you are at a distinct disadvantage for 2 reasons. 1, some people hear history and they think, oh God, let me head for the door. This is going to be boring. The second thing is that history is a subjective view of several concurrent realities. And I have never given this talk on AA's history and its context without learning something new. I am not an expert about AA. But I am a great beneficiary of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been a member of AA since the 1st of November of 1977. And I have known a good many people. I got sober in Richmond 25 years ago, and I was looking around the room, and there are 1 or 2 people who were in AA in Richmond when I got here. But my history and the people that I hold very dear to my heart in this area are people who have gone before us now. Chuck Cheadle, Wallace Mangus, Ted Partlow. These are guys that just were tall oaks in this area. There are so many others, many of whom are alive. And if I don't want to just get their heads too big by mentioning them in this group, but these are people who made the program of AA very, very real to me. And I have loved being an AA member, and I still love being an AA member. And yes, I can trace my sponsorship links all the way back to Dr. Bob and to Bill, because I've been in AA long enough to have had more than one sponsor. But I've gone and shot myself in the rear end here in the last few years. When my last sponsor died, who was a very distinct link to Bill Wilson in New York, one of his other pigeons and I decided to sponsor one another, so we just broke the chain. Because if I'm sponsoring him and he's sponsoring me, we're not going very far. But both of us have a great affection for the AA program. I have a reading list, and I'm just going to leave them up here. I printed enough for those that would like to have one. And I'm going to use it pretty much as my own outline. I also need to explain the reason for which I am interested in AA's history, not only because I am curious about it, but because I did some specific research on a graduate degree in American history a few years back, and my thesis topic was approximately, and I have it right here, why Alcoholics Anonymous necessarily separated from the Oxford group. And this dealt with a specific area of AA's history from about 1937 to 1941. In the course of doing that research for that, I came across a good many things and met a great many people. And I still get goosebumps when I think about some of the people whose company I've kept while I was doing the research and the contacts that I made. I'm still very, very excited about this, and AA's history continues to draw me on. I think to kind of preface again, that one of the interests that I had about the AA program was its spiritual roots. There's a fellow who's written a good many books, Dick Burns, and he lives in Hawaii. He may be dead now. He was no spring chicken when he began doing his research 10 or 12 years ago. But he wrote some excellent stuff trying to lay a groundwork. And some of the titles that he had were The Akron Genesis of Alcoholics Anonymous. Another of his titles was The Oxford Group and Alcoholics Anonymous. You may see them around. Most of them are soft-covered books, and they're bright yellow. And they're Dick B's works. And some of the earlier stuff is better than some of the later stuff. I think he began to recycle some of his earlier works into later editions, and I'm not sure that the result was that salutary, but the first stuff that he came out with was really dynamite. He also had a great affection for AA as a spiritual program. And I think there's where some of my interest comes. I had a degree in theology. I was an ordained minister for 18 years, 15 of them as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was interested in the roots of AA's unique and rather universal spiritual appeal to men and women of all sorts of religious backgrounds, or no religious background at all. How is it that the God business could be served up to recalcitrant renegade drunks in a way that would save their lives without them ever realizing that they were on a bended knee? So here was a matter of being led by example rather than being driven by mandate, and I thought that if the churches could figure out how to do that, you'd have to build a bunch of them in a hurry. As it is, I think AA would stay ahead of them by renting their basements for at least one night a week. And infuriating the hierarchy of multi-denominational worldwide organizations. While simply saving us from death, destruction, and jail. So perhaps the motivation for which AA got started is as important as anything. I believe that AA is a Christian phenomenon. I read a book, and part of my research was a book that was written by a fella named, name went right out of my mind right here, and I'm hoping it's on here. And it isn't, by jingo. It'll come to me. This gentleman wrote a book called AA, Cult or Cure. This guy's name was Buffet, Charles Buffet. He was from the Rational Emotive Behavioral Therapy Group in California, was definitely a rational recovery type of individual who found that the whole notion of surrender to God was absolutely ridiculous. He also accused Alcoholics Anonymous of trying to pull the wool over all of its members' eyes by saying that it is not a religious organization and by trying to pass off as a bunch of social hocus-pocus, very deeply spiritual beliefs. So therefore, after I got over wanting to take a trip to New York or to California to finish his story for him, I reread the book and came to discover that whatever he may have said about religious things, he had a hell of a lot of good things to say about AA's organizational structure and the ingenious way in which AA was dealt up to you and me. So on the one hand, I hope Buffet makes $1 million on his book, I hope that he dies with the ministrations of a religious practitioner against his will. But at any rate, no resentments here. So let me be very clear with you that AA comes out of the Protestant evangelical movement. It simply does. I mean, that's where AA owes its roots, not its allegiance, but certainly its roots. I want to take you back almost decade by decade and to talk about some specific individuals who played a huge role in the development of AA. The first one that I want to talk about was a gentleman named Frank Nathaniel Daniel Buckman. Buckman was the founder of the Oxford Groups. I wish to distinguish the difference between the Oxford Group movement and the Oxford movement. The Oxford movement was a phenomenon of the middle 19th century of high church Anglicans who came closer and closer to Roman Catholic roots. In fact, Cardinal Newman, who was a very high Roman Catholic thinker and philosopher and theologian of the late 19th century, began his life as an Anglican cleric, and as a result of his phenomenon in the Oxford movement, became Roman Catholic and arose to great heights. The Oxford group is a completely different bunch. The Oxford group is actually the outcome of Frank Buckman's strong sense of social justice within the Lutheran Church in the United States in the early 20th century. Buckman himself was the son of very devoted Lutheran people of Pennsylvania, went on to become a Lutheran pastor and was ordained in 1901 and became the pastor of a very small inner-city Lutheran congregation. During the course of his studies, he began to think in terms of evangelizing to the young people and the young workmen and their children in his town up in Pennsylvania. And he started a social group that was both educational and social to teach all sorts of adult skills to literally slum-dwelling kids. As a result of receiving a lot of financial assistance from the Lutheran Church, he set up a board of directors for his inner-city efforts. After several years, the board of directors cut his funding and literally nearly destroyed the man emotionally. He quit the ministry of that church and had a nervous breakdown, just quietly went off and came apart. His mother and father worried about him and put him on a boat for England, which is, I guess, a good thing to do with someone who's just had a nervous breakdown. I will say that he eventually did end up on a slow boat to China, but more of that or not. While he was attending a Protestant evangelical camp meeting and an annual convention of evangelicals in America, Canada, and Europe, it was called the Keswick Convention. The Keswick Convention is still a phenomenon within Protestant evangelical circles, and it draws speakers from all over the world. It is still in existence. But Buttman attended this in 1908. The way Buttman describes what happened to him may in some ways remind you of some of the things that Bill Wilson said about himself. He was terribly bitter about the people who he felt had wronged him and had run him out of his tenement ministry. And he was attending the Keswick Conference and happened into a chapel in the country, and a woman evangelist was talking about the Passion of Christ on the cross. And she talked about it in such clear and compelling terms that on the spot Frank Buttman had another conversion experience. He said that the experience so convicted him that he felt as though he stood on a mountaintop and that the clean wind of the Spirit blew through him. These are precisely the words that Bill Wilson used to describe his own experience in December of 1934. There are reasons for Bill's use of those words. Buttman made a list of all the people on the board who had dumped on him, and he wrote each of them a letter. He made a personal amends to each individual on that list. He also committed himself to serving others, and he also committed himself to a face-to-face, person-to-person evangelical mission from that point on. Now, there are some things that were extremely important for AAs out of those three principles. Direct amends, one-on-one, face-to-face work, and service to others from that point on. And these principles we still see existing in AA. Soon after he came back to the States, Buttman got a job as a campus minister, a YMCA minister, really, to a college in Pennsylvania. He moved on to a college in Connecticut, a theological college, and he began to gain some notoriety in the press. By this time, this is the early 20s. He was a very compelling man who believed that the only way to make religion or spiritual matters convincing was to go to individuals precisely where they were, not to stand behind a pulpit and talk to them about what they should do, but to go directly to people, being who they were being, and accepting them as they were. Two, he realized that most people that he would be dealing with knew less about religion than he did, and he was not there to impress them with his knowledge. He was there to help them to make a decision about Christ precisely where they were. So what he did is that he would meet people, and apparently he was just a wonderfully engaging, charismatic, happy fellow. The photographs that I've seen of him, he was probably 5'6" or 5'7". He was rotund. You could hardly consider him to be a physically appealing individual, but because of his genuine interest in people, they came to him. He made terrific inroads in his work with college students. This was both good for Buttman and it was bad. Good for Buttman because he began to make a difference. Buttman also realized that he needed to appeal to men and women who were going someplace in this world. So he had a tendency to go to the Silver Spoon crowd. I don't think that that was necessarily what he intended to do, but that's the way it came across. He was, he brought the message to the rich rather than to the poor. This got him into trouble later, and perhaps I can get back to that a little later on. Buttman also believed very strongly in engaging people and deepening of their prayer life immediately. And he had a technique whereby he could help people, as he said, to make a decision for Christ. He said, bring what you know of God to that encounter, and God will teach you to know yourself. Therefore, you did not need to have a very strong religious background to be exceedingly effective as a spiritual guide to others. And Buttman managed to bring that out very clearly. It was said of him that he got up very early in the morning and spent time in what was called quiet time. He did not even call it prayer and meditation or prayer time. He said quiet time because he felt that it had less strings attached to it of organized religion. And before long, Buttman had people getting up at 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning to come to his parlor where he left the door open to sit quietly in the room and meditate and pray over whatever they wanted to. Buttman also was a very, very strong believer in guidance. That if we placed ourselves in the presence of a higher power, that that higher power would, over time, put reasonable and useful thoughts in our minds. But Buttman also realized that human beings, being who they are, might tend to accept certain notions more quickly than they would accept other notions. And so Buttman also injected the idea of getting guidance from others to these thoughts that would come to them. We see it in the big book. We certainly see it talked about in the big book, is that we come to rely upon these intuitions, but we test them. We also see some of the beginnings of sponsorship as AA practices it, and the practice not only of prayer and meditation and silence, but also checking our thinking with others. So we see some of the shadows of our AA program and what this man is doing in the early 20s. Now, Buttman also got himself in a bit of hot water. Any person who draws attention to themselves will also draw negative attention. And I spent a lot of times looking through microfiche and through microfilms in libraries to find articles that were very critical of the Oxford group. And there were some. And the, I don't know, I'm not here to say whether or not Buttman was a good guy or a bad guy. He was a man of his times and he did the best he could. But because he appealed to young college-age men, because these young college-age men often talked about sexual problems that they were having, and in the, you know, things haven't changed a whole lot there, Buttman often would say to these people, these sins need to stop. And some people got a little bit angry with his decisions about their sex life and went off and talked to the press about it and hated Buttman ever after. But there were some others for whom Buttman had a terrific influence. Buttman finally got out of campus ministry when the heat got on a little bit, and he decided that he wanted to take his mission not only into colleges but worldwide. The Lutheran Church was still his denomination of choice, and he had an opportunity to do some missionary work in China. And there he is on the slow boat to China. He goes to China where his ideas were very, very much accepted by individuals in that culture. But there were also a group of young American seminary students who were in China at the same time Buttman was. And one of those individuals was a gentleman named Samuel Moore Shoemaker. And Dr. Sam Shoemaker eventually became Bill Wilson's mentor. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Buttman was fascinated by Shoemaker and Shoemaker by Buttman. Shoemaker was a young Episcopal seminary student. And when he was ordained, he accepted everything that Buttman had to say. Buttman was also quite unique for his time. The thought that a Lutheran could get along well with an Anglican was something rather unusual in the 20s. Most people stayed with their own denomination and thought all others to be rather, well, second-rate citizens. And so we see a level of ecumenism, which means interdenominationalism without anybody trying to steal the other guy's congregation. We see a great deal of that in the Oxford Group principles from start to finish. We also see some of that in AA's very laissez-faire notion about your spiritual or religious beliefs. So a very, very important fundamental concept of Alcoholics Anonymous and of the Oxford Groups. Shoemaker was just a dynamo, and Buttman, you knew how to use him well. Shoemaker was from a very wealthy Maryland family. His family still owns a plantation, literally a plantation, in just outside of Owens Mills, Maryland. And Sam Shoemaker is buried in the Episcopal churchyard in Owens Mills. My own personal history and my own history and progression of alcoholism had something to do with that graveyard. Perhaps I'll have a moment to tell you about it at the end. Long before I knew that Sam Shoemaker was born or was buried there, I was drunk there, so. Deja vu sometimes is not deja vu. I was here before. Anyway. Shoemaker was wealthy. He was very wealthy, and the family sent him off to excellent schools, and he landed a very nice sort of inner city mission church in New York City. And he, like Buttman, also had a great devotion to the down and outers. And he opened up a mission that was several blocks away from his parish church. It was at this mission church that Bill Wilson made his first surrender while between visits to Charles B. Towns Hospital in 1934. And I think although Shoemaker did not know Bill Wilson at that time, very soon after he did get to know Bill Wilson. If I could set just a little bit about the sort of religious and the political structure of the 20s and the 30s, if we were to look at Buttman, who, having gotten going in the 20s, that was the post-World War I era. This is a time of great sort of societal upsurge in our culture. This is the time of the 20s, the speakeasies, the prohibition, the rising interest in the stock market and buying on margin and terrific speculation. It was a time when Charles A. Lindbergh, flew across the Atlantic Ocean and became an overnight hero. It was a time when we saw the presidency of Calvin Coolidge, who was a man who was a Republican and very, very committed to the financial upper echelons of our society. And it was the generation just before Herbert Hoover, almost the minute he took over the presidency, had to deal with the aftermath of the stock market fall in October of 1929. This is also the time in which Bill Wilson was developing his career and working on his alcoholism. If you read the selection, Bill's story, in the big book, you'll see that Bill had served in the Coast Artillery during World War I and had gone to England. He returned home and went to law school. He decided that he was a lawyer, by the way. He just never passed the bar. He decided that he wanted to be a financial wizard instead, and so he got into stock speculating. The thought of him being a stock broker is a little bit too highfalutin for Bill Wilson. He was literally a shyster with stock certificates, and he made a lot of money for himself, and he made a lot of easy money for a lot of other people, but he was at that same time developing his own alcoholism. He was married to a very nice lady, and she had waited through the war. Well, I mean, they got married just before the war, before he went overseas, and she stuck with him right up to the time he died in 1971. She was a marvelous and very, very energetic lady, but she loved him probably more than he deserved to be loved. Bill Wilson says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that extreme drunkenness and good fortune have kept him out of many marital infidelities, but that's not entirely true. Lois Wilson waited for him and had literally devoted her life to him. She was unable to have his children. She made him really her great mission in life. But she was a very well-educated and well-schooled woman and quite a lady. And I don't think that anyone ever wanted to mention to Lois what they really knew of Bill, because they would not have done that to a woman of that magnitude and of her graciousness. But Bill Wilson was, for all intents and purposes, a rotten drunk. You hear him talk about it in reasonably cogent phraseology in the Big Book, how he would crawl home in the pre-dawn hours, and he would have to go to all-night places in order to get a few bottles of beer. But you don't hear, but what you read about in the book Pass It On, and Thompson's Bill W., and other stories about Bill is that he was inclined to go out and run all night long and wake up all covered with blood and puke in his own, at the bottom of the basement stairs of his own townhouse. He was a lush of the first water. And although we see him pretty well quite washed and dusted off, I think it's good for us alcoholics to remember that Bill Wilson was a human being. Let us not make an idol out of him. Let's not make some sort of a plaster saint out of this guy. He was a guy that went as far down as any drunk can go, and probably further than some of us went. So Bill Wilson certainly knew the booze racket right away. He stole from his wife, he sneaked off, he lied, he tried to get people to do things for him, he manipulated his environment to the best of his ability. No different than us. Bill Wilson ended up going to treatment at the tally, it varies between 3 and 4 times, depending on who you're talking to or who you're reading. I tend toward the 4 hospitalizations theory myself. Bill Wilson ended up being put in a drying out joint that was run by Charles B. Town. Really what Father Hilary Draper used to call a gold-plated souse trap. And he was there more than once. They tried various ways of appealing to Bill Wilson, but there was no appealing to Bill Wilson's ego. Bill Wilson would get himself out, he would think I've got the booze racket beat, he would get back on the hustle, and the next thing you know, he'd end up drunk. But a buddy of his didn't have it quite so good, and that was Abby Thatcher. Abby Thatcher and Bill Wilson had been great school chums up in Vermont, and Abby was quite an interesting fellow that showed up in Bill's life at various times. There is a story where Bill Wilson and Abby Thatcher decided to be the first people to land at a small airport up in a New Hampshire town. So they chartered a flight. Both they got drunk and the pilot got drunk. And they got lost. And the entire city, or bands in the whole city council, were all waiting for the plane when it landed. Bill, Abby, and the pilot all climbed out of the plane and forthwith fell on their face in front of the entire group of people for the inauguration of this new airport. This is Abby Thatcher, Bill's former drinking buddy. Abby had been pretty well, was going to be committed, that's what it came down to, and some people from the Oxford group went out and sprung him, that's what they did. And they sent him back home just to see if he couldn't get sober. And you know something, this is a very interesting phenomenon of Bill's life. Abby did not stay sober. Abby Thatcher had a terrible time with sobriety, and there are various times when I have a tape of Abby in 1955 at the St. Louis Convention. I have another tape of him just before he died. He was living in Texas when he died. Bill Wilson was his pigeon all the way through. Bill always spoke of Abby as being his sponsor. Bill always underwrote Abby to some extent and gave him money when he could. Bill never forgot how grateful he was that Abby had made that first call on him. He never got over it. And I think that in some ways we AAs could take a leaf out of that history, just to be grateful for what happened to us and to try to the best of our extent to pay back through service what somebody did for us. Bill Wilson never forgot Abby Thatcher, and he loved him to the day he died and to the day he himself passed away. Bill, here's the message, and it's talked about very clearly in Bill's story. It's talked about very clearly in Pass It On. It's talked about very clearly in AA Comes of Age. These are books that you can acquire at your home group. It's a wonderful stories. I also like to say that the only reason that I'm asked to stand up in front of you is because I've read these books. If you read these books, somebody will ask you to stand up here, too. Thank you. The 30s were a tough time. Our nation was in a terrible state financially. I mean, we just didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out for about 6 or 7 years in this country. The only reason that people's homes were safe is because Roosevelt was elected president and he stopped the foreclosure of mortgages in this country. That's the only reason Dr. Bob Smith still had a house to live in. And because Roosevelt literally saved his house for him by saying, you will not foreclose on the mortgages of individuals who borrowed money from your bank. Because your bank is no more secure than the people that you loan money to, so let's get over that right now. There will be no foreclosures. And it probably in some ways developed a way of looking at national rejuvenation in a way that we're still experiencing today. We still have some of the echoes of that type of social thinking today. At that time, it was unbelievably welcome. You know, at the same time that Bill Wilson was in his shape, Dr. Bob Smith, out in Akron, Ohio, was getting in the same shape. Dr. Bob Smith was born probably 200 miles from where Bill Wilson was born, maybe even less. These two fellows are a couple of Yankees, a couple of Vermonters. Bill Wilson settled in New York. Dr. Bob Smith ended up in Akron, Ohio. Dr. Bob Smith had attended Dartmouth College, which is still famous as a drinking school, and he said he mastered that level of curriculum. He took a couple of years off and then went to the University of Michigan to study medicine. He drank himself out of the University of Michigan, and when he came to himself, he ended up in Rush College in Chicago. Dr. Bob calls it another leading institution in America, but have you ever heard of Rush College? He graduated with an MD. Dr. Bob was a proctologist. A drunken proctologist is a dangerous individual. I have a feeling that the University of Michigan did not want it on its conscience or to its credit that it turned loose a drunken proctologist. Dr. Bob drank, and he drank a lot. He was also a very well thought of surgeon in the city of Akron. To his credit, he would not operate if he'd been drinking too much. He would not see patients if he'd been drinking too much. In the latter 3 or 4 years of his drinking career, he saw very few patients. In 1933, which was the year that Roosevelt was elected to the presidency of this country, that was in November of 33, but in 1933, in January, the Oxford Group, which had by this time become a nationwide phenomenon, made a visit to the city of Akron because the son and heir of a local millionaire was sobered up on a train ride out to Denver, Colorado to the Episcopal Church Conference by members of the Oxford Group, and the daddy of this individual decided to invite the Oxford Group to come take over all the pulpits of the city of Akron for a week in January of 1933. And there were several individuals who were in the congregation. Two of them, which were very important, were a woman named Henrietta Seiberling, who was the daughter-in-law of another rich tire millionaire, and her buddy, Ann Smith. Ann and Henrietta had their heads together about how to help Dr. Bob get over drinking, and they were not having much luck. Dr. Bob, very much like Bill Wilson, was terribly shy of things religious, very skeptical of them, did not want much to do with them, but Dr. Bob was having a tough time with the drinking business, and despite all of his efforts, was losing. So he then was willing to listen to his wonderful wife, Anne, and to Henrietta Seiberling, who was not so wonderful, but was certainly vocal. They began to pray for old Bob, and they got Bob going to the Oxford Group meetings that were held at various places throughout the city of Akron. Dr. Bob decided to join the Episcopal Church. He and Anne were attending the church of Dr. Walter Tunks in the city of Akron. Dr. Bob could not get sober. They prayed with him. They prayed at him. They prayed over him. And Dr. Bob, as good as he was, stayed drunk. It wasn't that he was being oppositional. It's just that the man simply could not see where the spiritual part and the drinking part came together. In November and December of 1934, Bill Wilson was visited by Abby Thatcher and went to Charles B. Towns Hospital for the next to the last and then the last time. And in that time, Abby visited Bill and brought to him the very simple program of the Oxford Groups. And he told Bill, "Bill, you just come up with your own notion of this God business, whatever works for you." And Bill bought that. And he had his, as he called it ever after, hot flash experience. He said that he felt as though he stood on the mountain top and the wind of the truth blew through him. And he said that he was changed from that point on. And Bill went on the Oxford Group Sawdust Trail along with Sam Shoemaker. There is some question as to whether Shoemaker or whether Bill Wilson ever met Frank Buckman. I've never been able to find any knowledge of a meeting between those two fellows. Buckman denied it because Buckman found that AA was really kind of small change when compared to his worldwide movement. We'll get into that right next. Bill and Bob get together in Akron when Bill goes out to try to win a stock proxy battle over a small machine tools company. He is in the Mayflower Hotel. Is there anybody here who's ever been to Akron to the Mayflower Hotel? It's just like being, you know, where it all began, is in that lobby. Bill comes down to the lobby. There's a bar. There's a church directory. They're within eyesight of one another. He went to the church directory. Who would he have called because of his experience at the Episcopal Church in New York? He called the Episcopal Church in Akron. Walter Tunks understood the Oxford Group. Walter Tunks gave him a list of names to call. Henrietta Seiberling invited him to come over because she had been praying so much for Dr. Bob that she felt that Bill was an answer from God, guided to her to help Dr. Bob. She then gets Dr. Bob and Bill together in the same room, and there it is. The strike became Alcoholics Anonymous. These two men meet one another. And Dr. Bob says, quite frankly, that Bill Wilson brought him something that no other person had ever brought him. Bill Wilson, and there's a pamphlet that's called out, Last Talks of Our Co-Founders. Also, there's a very interesting tape that Dr. Bob made in the city of Detroit in 1948, in which he outlines precisely what it was that Bill said to him that no one else had ever said. Bill brought to him the notion of service to others, selfless giving to others, and that's what made the difference to Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob then went out, and we have the story of his last beer, which Bill gave him on his way to do a proctological surgical procedure. And apparently all went well. Dr. Bob went out and began to make his amends forthwith. Came back to the house and never had another drink until he died in 1950. He and Bill stayed together for 3 months, both of them very active in the Oxford Groups. Bill returns to New York, very, very active in the Oxford Group. Shoemaker knew that he had an excellent speaker on his hands in Bill Wilson, and Bill and Lois were both very much on the evangelical trail with the Oxford Group. And in those years, or in those months and years, Bill was very definitely spoke out of a Christian perspective. Trouble happened, though, between the Oxford Group and Alcoholics and Bill Wilson, and trouble happened in this country with the Oxford Group, and they happened almost at the same time. And this is where the thesis of my history thesis took off. In 1936, remember now, Roosevelt was elected in 1933. In 1933, in January, Adolf Hitler was proclaimed the Chancellor of Germany, and within a matter of months had made himself the dictator of Germany. And he immediately began to back up the Treaty of Versailles, which had ended the First World War. He began to militarize Germany. He began to open up whole avenues of world conquest. It was not long before the democracies in the world began to be deeply concerned about Hitler. Well, Buckman hated the Bolshevists, the Russians, the communists, because they were godless, anti-Christian peoples. Frank Buckman in the New York Times is quoted as having said, "Thank God for a man like Adolf Hitler, who was thrown up a great bulwark against godless communism." Well, frankly, Hitler did. Hitler himself was a Roman Catholic, by the way, although not a terribly practicing one. though having known a few bishops, I wonder. However, he did throw up a bulwark against communism, and communism was atheistic, and Buttmann was definitely Christian. So anybody who was a friend of, or was an enemy of the communists must be a friend to the Christians, which of course is fallacious reasoning for all sorts of reasons. But in 1936, Hitler walked into the Rhineland, into the Ruhr in the Rhineland, and took it over again. It had been demilitarized by the French at 1918. He also began purposely excluding Jews from any social or political or governmental position in Germany. He began to speak about remilitarization and the establishment of the Luftwaffe, which was the German Air Force, which the Germans had hidden in Russia for several years anyway. However, you begin to see this, and the democracies are now worried. England is worried because they're only 20 miles from all this stuff. France is scared to death because they had their ass whipped by the Germans twice in a century. Russia is terrified because Germany had made an armistice with Russia in 1918 before the war was over, in 1917 before the war was over, and the terms were very negative to Russia. The only people that weren't afraid of Hitler was Mussolini. And frankly, he was a little afraid of him too. And so here you have Buttmann starting to roll this stuff out in 1936 about Hitler being a good guy in America, where Hitler was definitely not a good guy. Wilson was aware of this. Now, Wilson hated Franklin Delano Roosevelt with a purple passion. I'm surprised that he didn't throw in with Buttmann on that one. Well, figure it out. Wilson had made all his money under Republican administrations. And here was a guy who was giving it all away. And it was stopping, you know, the money flow to the wealthy. And so, although you never heard anything about Wilson's political feelings, it's because he chose not to talk about them. Wilson was also very committed to Christ during those years. Dr. Bob Smith was deeply committed to Christ in Akron, Ohio. In May of 1937, though, Bill Wilson had begun to realize that although the Oxford Group was bent on worldwide evangelism, Bill Wilson had a primary purpose, and that was to work with the still-suffering alcoholic. So he set up the alcoholic squad of the Oxford Group, which irked a lot of the Oxford Groupers, because, first of all, the drunks weren't high enough in the social scale. Second of all, Bill was doing something independently of the group initiative. Third of all, Bill was not following the guidelines. Fourth of all, Bill was separating himself from his own guidance and direction in the Oxford Group. And the word got out, and Bill heard about it. And Bill then, in 1937, pulled this alcoholic squadron out of the Oxford Groups. Now, he did it for two excellent reasons. One, the Oxford Group is getting a lot of bad press. Two, if we're going to be effective with drunks, we have to get shed of this Oxford Group stigma. And Bill Wilson did that to the day he died. You don't see anything about the Oxford Group in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. You do see some mention of it later on in the prefaces and the forewords to the various editions. But you don't see a damn thing about the Oxford Group specifically in the original text of AA. And it was my contention, and no one has refuted it to date, that Bill Wilson wrote the Big Book because he knew that AA needed its own independent, separate literature in order to break fully with the Oxford Group. Dr. Bob, on the other hand, in Akron, was very, very much into staying with the Oxford Group because he had many friends who were at Oxford Grouper, and he didn't see the big deal. And it wasn't until 1939 that Dr. Bob pulled the Akron group out of the Oxford group, and it created a terrific amount of problems for these men. They were personal problems because of affections that they had established. Some of the people that I spoke with about this when I was writing my thesis were Sam Shoemaker's wife, his widow, Helen Smith Shoemaker, and one of Sam Shoemaker's daughters, and I remember the conversation I had with his daughter. The old lady, Helen Smith Shoemaker, would not speak about any of that stuff. She simply would not. She said, "I refuse to talk about it." Well, what she didn't realize is that she'd written about it in about 1970 or 71 when she wrote a book about her husband. And there were an entire chapter about why the Oxford Group broke up in 1941 and Shoemaker removed himself from it. It was precisely the reason that Bill Wilson pulled out in 37 and Dr. Bob pulled out in 39 and Samuel Shoemaker pulled out in 1940 and 41. It's because of the political power that the Oxford Group was attempting to gather to itself, and its mission had changed from face-to-face work with other people to worldwide evangelism, and they were coming up with some pretty cockamamie stuff. In fact, Buckman put it to Sam Shoemaker that he wanted him to leave the Episcopal Church and become a full-time Oxford grouper, which again broke one of the original premises of the Oxford group, is that it would be an ecumenical movement and people could retain their own denominational identification. In the end, Buckman said, "I want you to be Oxford group, and only Oxford group." Bill Wilson saw that when they started talking about the drunks are only one part of this, you need to subjugate yourself to us and to the common goal. Well, you know the drunks. They weren't going to listen to a bunch of, well, in fact, there was one conversation that I had with a lady in this area in Virginia whose first meeting with anything to do with sobriety was through the Oxford group. And she spoke about, when I asked her, I said, "Did the Oxford group have any effect on your drinking?" She said they were nothing but a bunch of goddamn Christers. I think that was an opportunity missed. At any rate, the Oxford group was beginning to lose its appeal. It was beginning to get involved in world politics, and it was beginning to lose sight of itself. Bill Wilson, at that time, was beginning to focus on the side of what AA needed to do, and he saw that their primary purpose was absolutely essential, and we still have that in our traditions today. Bill Wilson focused everything on the drunk, the drunk, the drunk, period. He did not focus on the hows, he focused on the who, and then he helped them to develop the how. And that was Bill Wilson's focus then, and it came directly out of the Oxford group experience. Bill Wilson also, in the 1940s, when we went to war, Bill Wilson got a chance to see AA at work. He got to see AA succeeding even without the express permission of its original founders. And the AA Big Book was an extremely important part of that. And I think he hoped when he said it that a person armed with this book may go into any distant community and make a tremendous difference. Bill did not know when he wrote that in 1934 that was precisely what, or 1938, that was 37 it is, that this is precisely what was going to happen. That this small chip of a book would be floated out into the sea of alcoholism and it would have terrific impact on people's lives from that point on. I think Bill Wilson was as surprised as anybody else that AA took off the way it did. One of the things that Bill Wilson also recognized, and he took AA away from influence of an individual's ego. Buckman was a good man. Did you know that the Oxford group still exists? In 1938 it changed its name to the Moral Rearmament. And the Moral Rearmament still exists. They have a website. You tap it in any of your servers. Moral Rearmament. Bam. It'll be right there for you. It still exists. There are people still in the Oxford group who knew all the principles that I just spoke about. They're very old now, but they knew these people. They knew Shoemaker. They knew Buckman. And they're dying off rapidly now. But when I began this research on this thing some 10 years ago, there were a bunch of them still out there, and I had access to a few of them. So the Oxford group still exists. And so I think when AA says, "Well, nanny, nanny, poo-poo, you know, we did it right and they did it wrong," well, in effect, we did and they did too. But I think that as we see ourselves, let's not put ourselves up on any pedestal above these groups. Let's recognize the grateful contribution that they made to our sobriety today. I think in some ways when I talk and bring some of this stuff up, I want you to recognize that many of the things that we do in AA today are done almost in the spirit of the Oxford Group, and we owe them a debt of gratitude for that. We also see the reasoning behind it. So when people come in and say, well, I don't want to do this stuff, you know, where does he come up with this crap about the big book? Well, the crap about the big book is probably what saved this organization and put this organization on the map. When people talk about sponsorship, hey, I don't need a sponsor. Well, yes, you probably don't if you don't want one, but you'll be back if you live. And then maybe sponsorship will look a whole lot better to you. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, and we don't want power or authority because we don't want to misuse power and authority and get off on the track, on wild tracks. We are an organization that is actually the inverted pyramid, and I believe that in essence, AA works hard to do that, but the real power is at where there are the most people, and that is in the local groups, and that each group is autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. You're going to have candlelit groups, you're going to have men's groups, you're going to have gay groups, you have straight groups, you're going to have women's groups, you can have young people's groups, you can have any old kind of group you want, because Bill Wilson in 1937 had to haul the whole outfit out of New York away from the Oxford Group because they wouldn't let them practice the principles in the way that were most effective to the people he was working with. And Bill Wilson never forgot that. Several years ago, I was giving a talk at the Ohio Young People in AA Convention. And frankly, folks, I haven't looked any younger since I got into AA. And I was dressed about like I'm dressed now, and I walked into this hotel lobby in Ohio, and it was the damnedest thing I ever saw in my life. I mean, there were leather and chains and tattoos and miles of skin hanging off of every single piece of furniture in the place, hair of every imaginable color, enough holes knocked in these people to make them all look like colanders, and I'm It has never been my wont to suffer pain to look different, you know, just never. And I'm walking in here with my suitcases, dressed about like this, looking about like this. And my wife says, I wonder what Bill Wilson is thinking right now. And I said, I bet he's just happy as hell that these people are here. And in the course of that time, after I'd given my kind of weak lead, I mean, there were some kids that in 11 had done more stuff than I did by the time I was 30. And through no fault of my own, just that some of that stuff wasn't around when I got sober. But, I mean, these young people were coming up and literally laying their head on my chest and say, I can identify with you. I identify. We share experience, strength, and hope. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, you know, they're right. They're absolutely right. And they're right because of the history that we share. Now, let me say a word about the history that we're writing today. AA is going to persist. It's going to be all right. It's going to be different than the way it was. I've been in AA for a quarter of a century. If I stay in AA for another 5 years, I'll have been in AA half my life. And has AA undergone some changes? I know, sure it has. You know, but I'm not afraid. I'm not in the least bit afraid. There's several reasons why. One, as long as there are people around who believe that the book is important to us and that it is the textbook of people and members of this fellowship is going to be okay. Because the people who are in the know are always going to offer experience and strength and hope to people who aren't. Two, if we can continue with the spirit of service in AA, even the most radical, rebellious renegade will eventually realize that sublimating that self-will is the way that they will save their own lives and the way that they're going to save other people's lives. Three, AA is mercilessly democratic. You try to pull any really kinky shit in AA and somebody's going to get you. And you won't know where it's coming from. It isn't going to be Methuselah in the back row with moss on his back. It could be a 16-year-old kid who says, get over yourself. You could convince a great many people of a great many things in AA, but you can never convince people that your way's the way. The AA way becomes our way of dealing with the world. Now, I live in a family where I am the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife is a member of a 12-step organization, but we never, ever do anything but discuss the steps in generic fashion in my home. I have two children who see Daddy go to meetings, and that's all those little ones need to know. In fact, I've gotten one who went to her first meeting and made it through the whole hour here about 3 weeks ago. And that's because I followed the example of other AAs with small children and packed enough crap in a carry-all bag. But it took her 45 minutes to get to the bottom of the things. I'll also say this about AA. AA is an endless progression of personal growth. You know, now this is some of the stuff that I think the history of AA, and I hope that your history will be exactly the same. But when you got to AA, you aren't that person today. That person is still there someplace, and if you want to go back to drinking, you can find them in a hurry. But we're not the people we were when we got in AA. We're at a different place than we were when we got in AA. And if we're living this program a day at a time, we're doing the best we can, every opportunity that AA offers is going to be there for us. And we will be the history of AA. Now, I was driving back from a meeting here several weeks ago, and it was in a distant town, and I was riding with a fellow that I sponsor, and the guy got into sobriety. I don't know, he's been probably sober 17, 18 years now. And we were driving up the road, and he said, you know, we don't see many of the old-timers in the meetings anymore. And I flipped down the sun visor, and there's a mirror on it. And I said, take a look. And his next words, I thought, were wonderful. Jesus Christ, do you think those... Do you think those guys knew as little as I do? Yeah, they did. They knew as little as we do. And there is no popes, nor pontifex maximus, nor presidents of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are all people who are trudging a road of happy destiny. And we are all people who I think are some of the luckiest individuals on the face of this earth. I want you to pass it on. I've got, like I say, it's one list. I've got, I don't know, 75 copies of this. Some of the stuff that's on this list, you can get at your home group. Some of the stuff that's on this list, you can't get at your home group. But if you tap in and you start putting these names down, you can find them. Probably Amazon.com. You can get a lot of these books from Amazon.com. I'm not going to make any particular recommendation outside of the big book in the 12 and 12, but then Pass It On, and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and AA Comes of Age. I think these are just ingenious volumes. I've read them probably a dozen times each. There's another one that is not that I hope you don't find a conference-approved literature, right? And that's Ernest Kurtz, Not God, A History of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the book that put me on the road to understanding more about fellowship. It's one of those books where you have two bookmarks. You have a bookmark where you're reading, and you have a bookmark where the footnotes lead you, because sometimes the footnotes are just as enlightening and as explosive and as fun as the text of the book. Kurtz, I did a great, great service to me. I've had the pleasure of meeting him. I also would say that in this town, there are people in AA who just loom larger than life. Please get to know those individuals. They're not going to be with you forever. And then I want you to learn as much as you can from them, because someday you're going to be the old AA fart. And you may as well know from whence you came. Thank you very much for your patience and your attention.